Marshall Hanley. Students, teachers, faculty, everybody. I'm delighted to be here. Some statements like that are not going to sound, that I'm going to give in the course of my speech, are not going to sound very original, but if you clap anyway, it makes me feel good. But I'm very pleased to be here, and I'm very pleased to see all of you. I was going to have buttons for all of you. You know, buttons with a picture on it. Which I thought would be marvelous, and I gave it to the assignment to my younger brother, Teddy, to get the button ready, and I said I'd distribute it when I got to Ball State University. And then I found out, I gave that assignment to him, and then after President Johnson's speech on Sunday in which he said he wasn't going to be a candidate for president, I found that all the buttons had my brother Teddy's picture on them. And I told him it was too late for him to get in this campaign. He gave me his slogan, which he put on a paper: the candidate's ready, it's not Bobby but Teddy. But I thought it was going well, my campaign. Especially when I was out in California and I received a telephone call from George Hamilton. He asked for my daughter's telephone number, which I think. I had a request to appear at a certain university in one of the primary states in which I'm involved. And the student body president wrote me an interesting letter, which I thought I'd pass on to you. He said he thought my appearance might liven things up. He said, things are so dull out here that when we take LSD, we see Lawrence Welk. It's not bad, though, was it? But I'm pleased to be here, and I'm going to give a speech, and then I will be glad to answer questions that any of you might have at the end of the speech. Easy questions. You know, is it colder in the East than it is out here? But I will be glad to do that. So some of the subjects in which I cover and less detail, I would be glad to go into and at greater length in a question period after I speak. Some have said that the events of the last few days have made the commitment to leadership and this election irrelevant. They say that the war in Vietnam is on the way to being settled, or that the election is unimportant now, or that our course at home is clear. But abroad and at home, it seems to me that critical questions still remain. What kind of help and how much shall we give to the undeveloped nations of the world? What kind of policy shall we forge in order to keep the peace? What will our relationship be to the nations of Europe, the nations of Africa, the nations of Asia, even if Vietnam is settled? What kind of programs can we develop to build a better America here at home, and to bring help to the people who still live lives of deprivation? What will, in fact, be our policy after Vietnam? What should it be? These are the hardest of issues, and there are no easy answers, really, to any of them. But if we are to make the right choice, it seems to me that we must confront these issues openly and honestly. I think the Democratic Party has accomplished a great deal over the period of the last 7 years. I think that we've done a great deal here in the United States. I think that we've done much which we can be proud in our relationship with other countries. I think we've made mistakes. But it seems to me that the Democratic Party, if it's going to get elected, and if And the way I run is that we have to look, not just talk about what we've done in the past, not just talk about what we've accomplished in the past, but people want to know what we're going to do in the future, what we think the situation is at the moment, and what we intend to do to bring peace around the world and bring prosperity and happiness and to our own people here at home. It's on that basis that I run for President of the United States, and on that basis that I ask for your support. Seems to me that particularly college students, but all of us in the United States, and especially in such a critical year of 1968, which is going to determine the future and the destiny of so many people, not only in the United States, but all over the globe, and this is the year in which people can decide, not 1969 or 1970, it's year 1968, which is going to determine the direction that the United States is going to move, what kind of leadership we're going to have. It seems to me that we have to have the spirit that Plato reported, that all things are to be examined and brought into question, that there is no limit set to thought. And that's what I think, that's the spirit that we need on a university campus, and that's the spirit really that we need in this election year of 1968, to examine everything, not take anything for granted, to examine everything and see where we are, as Abraham Lincoln said in 1858, where we are. Only when we know where we are will we know where we can go and how we can get there. We must look carefully and honestly at our policies abroad. We must examine how we can help the millions of our fellow citizens who lead lives of hopelessness and poverty. As Sophocles said, where day follows day, with death the only goal, what joy is there in day that follows day, with death the only goal? We must decide what moral obligations we have to the other peoples in the globe, peoples of Latin America, and some of the villages that I visited, and I'm sure that some of you have visited, where 7 out of 10 children die before their first birthday, that the average person who dies in Latin America is under the age of 4, that the starvation and the difficulty and the hopelessness that face those people, about the men in Asia, who have less to eat now than they did at the start of the decade, about those in Africa, whose every living moment is filled with disease, for those who know only suffering and deprivation, where we lead relative lives of comfort and of happiness, where each year, at the some time that all of this is going on all over the globe, each year we in the United States spend $3 billion on pets, almost $2 billion on dogs. And yet all of the starvation and all of the suffering takes place all over the rest of the globe. These men and women and children that we hear about and which I'm talking about now, they're not statistics. They are human beings that I have seen and I think that many of you have seen, each with a right to lead a life of dignity and purpose, just as much as you and I have. We happen to be fortunate enough to be born in the United States of America. We happen to be fortunate enough to be able to attend a high school and then go on to a university. But what did we do in our lives that gives us that right, instead of being born in Northeast Brazil and not even living to your first birthday? Or being born in East Africa or Tanzania and where 97% of the people are illiterate. What did we ever do? Or what did we ever contribute? What can we ever say that we ever did? What really is our purpose in life? And it finally comes down to it, that we could be born with all of these advantages that we enjoy here in the United States, and they, 70-80% of the rest of the world, suffer as much as they do. And when you finally decide that, then you must also decide what we can do to make up for all of the advantages that we have. Don't we have a major responsibility to those that do not have those advantages? Don't we have a major responsibility, not the government of the United States, but we as individuals, have a major responsibility and obligation to those who don't have the advantages that we do. We are the most exclusive minority in the world. They talk about minorities. We're the most exclusive because we have a college education. Such a small percentage in Latin America, the average education is 3 years of school. But in many parts of Africa, it's less than that, and in Asia, even less than that. What a great advantage then we have, and how are we going to use those advantages? What are we going to do with the talent that was given to us Whether we're going to use it on behalf of ourselves, whether we're going to use it on behalf of others, that's the major question. Really, the only purpose, in the last analysis, the only excuse really for our existence must be that we have to perform some act, do something on behalf of those who are less well off. And I think you recognize that, and I think the people of the United States recognize that. And there are other vital questions. How shall we protect the security of our allies and of ourselves? And what kind of policy shall we erect in the name of this security? These decisions are not those of officials. They are yours as well as those who represent you. You cannot point to others and say, this is their choice. This is not my responsibility. For when they act, when we act in Washington, when we act in the executive branch of the government, or those who represent you elsewhere in government, they act in your name. When they conduct a war, when they war, they do so for your future, and really in the name of the American people. So it is upon you, as much as any official, as any president, to ask whether this is the policy, or any particular policy, is a policy that you wish to follow. It is up to you to ask what we should do in Latin America, what we should do in Africa, what we should do, for instance, in Guatemala, a nation where there are priests and nuns who have left the Maryknoll order and who declare that only through open rebellion can social justice be achieved. Is that true? Now, we give great aid to Guatemala. We've had a close relationship with Guatemala for a long period of time. Is the aid and assistance really going to the people? Or is the aid and assistance that we're giving to countries of Latin America being used just to control the people and keep them relatively happy so that they won't change the system? And should we continue on that basis? Should we continue under those circumstances? And where are the countries that this aid and assistance that we pay for, where is it being used on behalf of the people, and where is it being used on behalf of just a few in power, whether they be military power or have great financial power? It is up to you to decide. Really, in this election year, and this is the opportunity that you have, what we should do in Thailand, which has now more American troops than were in Vietnam at the start of 1965. It is, above all, up to you to ask whether we shall protect our security by leveling the towns and villages of another land, and whether we're willing to say, with the candor of an American officer at Ben Tre in Vietnam, that it became necessary to destroy this town in order to save it. Now, he wasn't saying that just for himself. He was saying it also for you. And you saying it for the American people. And what is our responsibility? And therefore, what should be our policy in dealing with problems like that? These are moral problems, they're security problems, they're problems for all of you, for all of us as United States citizens. You must help in all of these complex questions because you will bear the burdens of errors or misjudgment. President Kennedy once said, and I think very true, that you, the younger generation, you have the least ties to the past and the greatest stake in the future. So what happens in the decisions that we make are going to have the greatest stake in your lives, the greatest effect on your lives. We might be the government officials that carry out policy, or we might be the ones that implement it, or we might be the ones that begin it or stimulate it. But the last analysis, the people that are this policy is going to have the greatest effect on is going to be all of you. The question of what kind of lives we're going to lead, the quality of life that's going to exist in the United States, whether there are going to be these tremendous divisions between blacks and whites, between various age groups on our foreign policy, the quality of life, that's going to be really have the, or even whether there's going to be life itself. That's going to be, these are the questions that are being decided, and these, seems to me, have the greatest effect on you more than any other generation. We have made mistakes in the past. As I've said before, I was involved in mistakes. There were mistakes made during the administration of President Kennedy, undoubtedly mistakes that were made regarding Vietnam, of which I was intimately involved. But what I hope is that we look to the past. We look to the past and we see where we've erred and where we've done right, and we benefit by the mistakes that we have made. And that's what I think that we can do here in the United States of America. Are you all going to stand up because you're leaving, or is it just... Why don't you just move forward and then there'd be more room, wouldn't there? Just move forward. Now, why don't you just... Why don't you sit down there? Just sit down if you would, could you? Just sit down over there.
As you can hear, the senator invited the students to come up closer to give the ones on the floor more room, and in doing so, they knocked out the television lights. They've caused some problems for the communication mediums.
Sit down, please?
And as you can hear, the senator is asking everyone to please sit down and remain calm. So as the students do so, we'll return you now to the podium.
Are you all right? Listen, would you get down so that those people back there, so I can see them? Seriously, would you sit down, please? Would you just sit down there, please? I'm not waving. Back there. Just in fairness. It seems to me that in addition to our responsibilities abroad, that we have responsibilities here at home, and this also involves our personal responsibility. For there are, despite the fact that much has been done, there's much left that is undone. And these failures, it seems to me, are all of ours as well. Here in America, there are children so underfed and so undernourished that many of them are crippled for life, in mind and body, before the age of 3. Here we have one of the most wealthy states. Here we are in a wealthy farm area, which has great production, as well as industry. And a state that has produced all kinds of things, and yet here in the United States, it produced you, and that's all kinds of things. But at the same time, while we have this great affluence and this great produce, we have young children in the United States by the tens of thousands who are gradually starving to death. And not just malnutrition, but actually starving to death in the United States. So therefore, as the doctors who have examined them in the Delta area of Mississippi said that they will never be mentally, they might live until the age of 20 or 30 or even 40 or 50. They might live, but they will never be mentally equipped to deal with any of the problems. They will have been permanently destroyed because they haven't had enough to eat. I've seen them, maybe some of you have seen them, with the distended stomachs and the faces covered with the sores of starvation. This is in the United States. And there are children, as we sit here tonight, children by the tens and tens of thousands who will go to bed hungry because they will either have had two meals a day or they have had to get by on bread and gravy or just beans. That exists in the United States of America in the year 1968, and I think it's unacceptable, and I think we should do something about it, and it's one of the reasons I run for President of the United States. There are men in eastern Kentucky who seek work and dignity and receive in only in exchange for that an offer of a welfare handout. I think we should have jobs instead of welfare in the United States. There is bound to be some welfare for those who are blind and for children, but for men and for women who are ready and able and willing to work, we should have jobs instead of welfare, and I think we should move in that direction. There are families in our ghettos who huddle 10 to a room, fighting off the night terrors of cold and rats. There are young men on Indian reservations so filled with despair and the bitter prospects ahead that the leading cause of death amongst teenagers in many Indian tribes across the United States, the first Americans, the leading cause of death amongst teenagers is suicide. So filled with despair, so filled with hopelessness. And I think that's the responsibility of the United States government, yes, but I think it's all of our responsibility, the rest of us. These are individuals, again, not statistics. Men and women and children condemned to suffer by our inaction, leading lives to deprivation as we live in relative comfort. I think a nation which can spend $200 million to build a super jet to send people to Paris or to Rome or to Tokyo can afford to feed the hungry children of the state of Mississippi. I think this is our responsibility. I think it's yours and mine. And I want to fulfill that responsibility. And that's why I run for President of the United States. Consider the most elementary social right of an American child today, the right to be free from the threat of starvation. No one in this country, no matter what his politics, no matter what his prejudices, could wish starvation on a child. It is an image really too brutal to consider. Yet I have seen these children in this nation, in this year. Our response, which represents a people with half the world's wealth and a gross national product of $800 billion a year, I don't believe has simply been adequate. In some states, less than 2% of the poor are reached through food programs, and much of the food that is distributed is spoiled. There's no program to teach families how to prepare decent meals out of the flour and the grain, which forms much of the dough. The law says a man can buy food stamps, enabling him to buy a large amount of food for a small amount of cash. Yet how do men in eastern Kentucky or in Mississippi, with 8 children and no income at all, how do such men find $12 a month for food stamps? The law says a man is to be charged what he normally spends on food. What is the sum for such a man if he has no job and he earns nothing? The law says a man must come to town to buy his stamps. How can a man buy stamps at all if he must pay as much to travel as he does to buy the stamps when he finally gets there? That kind of delay, that kind of inaction, that kind of indifference to the starvation of children has no place in the United States. It is not the way we want our government to act, and it is not the way that we want our society here in the United States to act, and that's what I intend to change. It is admirable, and I support it, that we will spend $1.4 billion under the Food for Peace program to help feed the hungry abroad. But it is intolerable that we are spending no more than half that much to provide food for the hungry here in the United States. For as I say, we speak not of statistics or numbers, but we speak of human beings. We speak today of a child who will never walk properly, who will never play, who will never learn and work and raise a family because of our indifference. Time will not wait, and it seems we must act. And the time to act is now. These are not the failures of one man or one administration. but the failures of our society. And I focus attention on them again. I focus attention on them to say that this is part of the unfinished business that we have here in the United States in the year 1968. I think because of the great wealth and the great affluence that we have in this country, that we lose sight of the fact that there are those who are deprived, whose voices we never hear, who have nobody to speak for them and nobody to work for them. And the one group really who feels a moral responsibility, it seems to me, not the only group in the United States, because I think that's what this country represents, but a group that really should feel a moral responsibility for fellow human beings who suffer are the young people of this country. And I think that you should take this on as a burden to do something about and to change the course and direction that we're taking at the present time. These are conditions which have existed all too long in the United States, and it seems to me can be allowed to exist no longer. And the fact is, in addition to what you yourselves can do as individuals, that much can be done. We can begin to end the disgrace of starvation in the world's wealthiest nation by making food stamps free to those who cannot afford them, who have no income at all, by dispensing meals in mobile kitchens to families that cannot reach the cities, as there are many in the hollows and of Kentucky and West Virginia still and other areas of the United States, Oklahoma, by spending fully the funds that are already appropriated. The Department of Agriculture returned more than $200 million to the Treasury last year, which could have been spent on these kind of efforts, by instituting emergency programs in every county where the need exists. As I said, many, many counties have no kind of food program where there's tremendous hunger and tremendous need and tremendous poverty, have virtually no programs to speak of. By employing community citizens as nutritional aides, teaching families to prepare meals with the food that they can obtain. And it seems to me that we must do more than just meet the present emergency. This deals with those who are hungry at the present time, but to prevent it in the future. We must act against the root cause which imprison men in poverty. One, I think we must act in the field of employment by making the government the employer of last resort and by helping private enterprise build industry in our urban and rural pockets of poverty by giving special tax credits and tax incentives to the private sector. In housing, by making it profitable for the private sector to build low-income housing. In health, by establishing community centers staffed by professional and community residents alike. In education, by funding those programs which can really teach children how to learn. All this we can do, not by delegating power to a bureaucracy, not by sending more money and by passing new laws, but by channeling the concern of our own individual citizens, you and me, into that sense of personal responsibility which will produce action. For this is our nation, its triumphs and its glories, its failures, but also its shame and where we have failed. It is for us to turn this country toward a path of honor, not through arms or wealth or force, but through that redeeming conviction of national innocence and by finding our own satisfaction in the conduct of our country and in the conduct of ourselves as individuals. This is the surest road to a better America and to fulfilling our own personal responsibility. It was Albert Camus who once said that perhaps we live in a world, and this world is a world in which children suffer, but we can lessen the number of suffering children. But he asked his audience, and it was a university, and he asked his audience, perhaps we can prevent this, perhaps we can lessen the number of suffering children. But if you will not do this, then who will do this? And I ask the same question of you. If you will do not do this, if we will not do this, if we won't make the effort for our own citizens here in the United States, if we won't make an effort to develop a policy and a program to help those in other lands, how can we survive here in our own country? We can see it, the riots and the lawlessness that have taken place in some of our cities during the summer. We cannot tolerate violence, and we cannot tolerate lawlessness, and we cannot tolerate violence. But the fact is that some of our fellow citizens have turned against our society and turned against our government. people perhaps that you do not see, people that perhaps you do not come in contact with, but they feel that their children can't get a decent education. They see their children 1 year behind and losing 1 year by the time they get to the third grade, 2 years behind the sixth grade, losing 10 points on their IQ between the fifth and the eighth grade in the ghetto schools of the United States. Do they want to accept that? They see a third of the graduating class, those that graduate, maybe 4 or 5 years behind. Only 3 out of 10 ever graduate from high school in our ghetto schools in the United States. Only 3 out of 10 ever graduate. And of the 3 out of 10 that graduate, they have a 50-50 chance of having the equivalent of an eighth grade education. They can't go on to a college. They can't go on to a university. They can't get a decent job. There's no employment in the ghetto that they can get other than the most the worst kind of unskilled jobs are going sweeping out someplace. And there are very few of those left. So what do they do? And what would you do? What would all of us do? You're filled with despair and hopelessness. 17,000 people bitten by rats every year. What would you do? And the fact you can't get a job, only 40% of the men that live in the ghetto have jobs that pay more than $60 a week. How can you support a family? How can you bring up children in dignity? 43% of the housing run down and dilapidated. How can you raise a family under those kind of conditions? The fact is that this still exists in the United States of America. And these people can't find jobs. And in many parts of the United States, you cannot stay with your wife. You cannot get assistance or help of any kind if your family stays together. We believe in the family unit in the state of Indiana. You believe in it here. But the family unit means something. But in many areas of the United States, you can't get aid or assistance unless you're divorced or unless the children are illegitimate. So that the result is a higher and higher rate of illegitimacy. Because you know you can't get a job. You know the children aren't going to get an adequate education. You know the housing is going to be substandard. And that they're not going to get any aid or assistance from the government, the city or the federal or the state government, unless the children are illegitimate. And so you have a child watching outside while the man goes in to stay with his wife or stay with the woman to tell him if a guard is coming. That's what we have in our society in the United States of America. You wonder about what's happening in New York, or you wonder what's happening in Chicago, or you wonder what's happening in Los Angeles or Watts. I say there's no excuse for the violence, and there's no excuse for the lawlessness, and there's no excuse for the disorder, and we cannot accept it under our society. But what is also necessary is that we understand one another, that you understand their problems, and that the black people of the United States understand that you are concerned about them, and that you want to do the right thing, and that the divisions that exist and the polarization that exists in the United States ends, and that we make an honest effort to understand one another and move forward together. I think that's what the United States stands for, and that's why I run for president.
With those remarks, Senator Kennedy has ended his speech here at Main Gymnasium at Ball State University. He is receiving a standing ovation from the crowd. He is going back to the platform again.
I hate to ask you to sit down again. Such an effort. But we'll have, if you want to have questions for a few minutes, I'll be glad to stay and do that. I'll get you. Go ahead. Excuse me?
Oh, McCarthy.
Oh, excuse me?
Well, sir, you spent 15 minutes telling jokes and another 20 devil talking, and devoted approximately 30 seconds to your
half break. I'll be glad to answer. Now, I think it's a perfectly legitimate question. Would you like, you asked me some specific question in which you want to have what I think we should be doing. You want me to tell you what I think I should do about the cities or what? The jobs? All right, I'll tell you about jobs. I thought I answered it.
Senator, I admire your ability to recognize problems.
I don't mind. He's perfectly entitled to his point of view. He's perfectly entitled to express his point of view, and he's perfectly entitled to disagree with me. And it's the only way that we're going to make progress in this country if people stand up and speak their mind. So. I think there are a lot of different kinds of problems. One is the question of the cities. I told you some of the things that I think that we should do. One is as far as the cities, that we have to make it clear about the violence and the lawlessness. But I think a very important part of all of that is to provide jobs. And I said in the course of my speech that I thought that the government had to be the employer of last resort, that was the most important thing, that I would move away from the welfare system that we have here in the United States at the present time, and I would move toward jobs. I would do it through the government. And the second, which is a longer range program, which I think is terribly important, I'd do it through the private enterprise system. I'd give tax credits and tax benefits to the private sector if they would go into the ghetto or they would go into the rural areas of unemployment and they would establish a business there or a factory there. I would give them a tax credit for the construction of the factory. I'd give them an extra credit for taking people off welfare and employing them. I would give them a tax credit if they put up housing. I'd make arrangements under the housing bill so that the people themselves, after a period of 2 years, could purchase the housing from the original builder of the housing, so that people would start to own their own homes in the rural areas and in the urban areas of the United States. Those are two of the things I would do. I'd be glad to answer, just in fairness to me, well, I'll answer that too, but just, I think, just if I could say in fairness to me, that I'd be glad to answer the questions, and I tried to answer them specifically about what steps I think should be done about food. I outlined a program. I've written a book in which I've set forth some of my thoughts about these matters. I've introduced legislation in many of these matters. I'd be glad to furnish that to you. And I've said I'd open myself to a question period, so I'd be prepared to answer any questions. So I hope that you will have some charity toward
Senator.
Your...
Senator.
Now, somebody wanted to ask about the draft. Somebody asked about
Senator,
the draft.
Now, I...
I know. About war. I'm against war. But I think that everybody else, I don't think that's a very original thought, because I think everybody else is against war. Let me just tell you, I'll tell you what I think about the draft. Could I answer one question? That's easy if I can answer one question at a time. First, I think what we should move toward in the United States is a professional army rather than a draft system. Second, I think that the draft, as it is established at the present time, is inequitable and unfair. And I think the drafting of graduate students in the way that it's been developed, and the oldest students at graduate school, I think is a very major error. Third, and while this conflict goes on and while the war goes on, I think that I would be opposed as much as possible to deferments of any group, and I would be in favor of a lottery system with everybody treated equally. Let me just ask you how many, I'll ask you about what you think. I'll ask you two questions. How many are in favor of student deferments and how many are opposed to them? First, how many in favor of student deferments? And second, how many are opposed to them? I'm just going to go into this a little bit more detail. I think that, as I made it clear, I'm with the second group, which is a minority, and I'll tell you why I'm with them. Because once again, I think that this is a heavy burden, this war. There are men that are dying on behalf of all of us as we stay here, and while men go to school. Now, there are many places in the United States where you can't go on to a college. There are many places in the United States you can't go on to a university. So there are many places in the United States where you cannot get a draft deferment by going to a university. Now, is that person, that individual that lives in one town, and for one reason or another, he doesn't go on to a college or a university, he has to go be drafted and go and fight in Vietnam and possibly be killed, while somebody else goes on to a college or university and doesn't have to go. I just... if you just look at it, for those of you who said that you should have draft deferment and have, you know, a deep moral sense, is can you really defend draft deferments for students on a moral basis that really, in the last analysis, it's the poor that have to carry the burden of the war? It's the... No, it's the... If you look at the statistics of where men have come from, they come from Eastern Kentucky, which is very, very poor, where there are not many chances or opportunities to go on to a university. If you are Negro and you're eligible for the draft, you're twice as much likely to be drafted as a white person. Let me just say to you again, this is a war in which men are being killed at the rate of, lately, at 400 or 500 a week. There are, up to at least to the Tet Offensive, and I haven't seen the statistics up to that, only 10% of our population is Negro, yet more than 20% of those who were killed and wounded in Vietnam are Negroes. The ones that the Mexican-American, who again is poor in the United States, poorer than the Negro, is carrying even a greater burden. The Indians carry a greater burden. The Puerto Ricans carry the greater burden. The burden of the conflict, the burden of the fighting and the war is being carried by the poor and those who can't go to a university or college. So how can we then say that as long as you can go on to a college or a university, that perhaps either whether your parents, for instance, in my own family, obviously I can find some college or some university somewhere around the country that my sons can go to. But there is a poor person whose sons might be equally as bright and might contribute equally as much to society and their country and might equally not want to go to Vietnam and spend several years being shot at. They can't, because they're poor, they can't go to a university or a college. How can we say that is fair? How can we say that is just? And I don't think it is, and I can't believe that you do all either. I'll come back to you. All right.
I agree with the program and proposals that you are making.
Thank you. Can you stop just there? Yes. I think that obviously it's faith in white America. I'm also placing faith in black America. Let me just say, I think that there are, can I answer? I think that there are extremists on both sides. I gather, although there's a shadow up there, that you're a different color than me. Let me just say, I think that there are black people and there are black extremists who do not like white people, and I think that they are teaching violence and lawlessness and disorder and say that there's no future under our government or under our society. I think they're to be condemned, and I think they're performing a disservice for their own people. I think that there are white people who say that they are concerned about black people and that the black people are inferior and therefore they don't want to treat them as equally. I think they're both, that is a small minority of the white people, and I think the vast majority of American people want to do the decent and the right thing here within our country. The question was, do I think the anti-poverty programs have been and the economic opportunity programs have been as successful as they should be, and what would be my suggestions about them? First, I don't think that they have been as effective as we would have hoped. I think part of that is the fact that we are changing our system a great deal. Before the poverty program, we were coming in and the government or the city or the state was coming in and doing things for other people. You established a housing program, you went in, and you told people what the program was. Here, it's more of a revolutionary concept in that we're letting people do things for themselves, and then we're letting them develop their programs. This is the first opportunity and chance many of those people have had. So while they're doing things and developing things, they're going to also make mistakes and commit errors. Everybody does. And I think there's been a great deal of attention focused on that. But I think that was inevitable. Secondly, we've cut back on the funding over what would have been expected to be that was going to be available for any of these programs. So there's been a good deal of disappointment in the Head Start programs, disappointment in the job training programs, in the job camp programs, and in many of these other programs, which thought that they would begin and then they would be able to expand and then they would find jobs and that there would be great progress. Instead, they've had to cut back. Third, I don't think that we've done enough. My specific criticism of the program, finally, as it comes into fruition, that we've done enough to follow up to ensure that when we train a man in a job program, that there is a job for him at the end. Secondly, that we're training him for a job or for employment that actually exists, instead of just putting him through the motions, training him for a job, and then putting him out in the cold. I don't think we followed enough in some of these programs. I think there's been an inefficiency and waste. I agree with the program in concept. I think it was inevitable that we would have some difficulty with it, but I think that it's accomplished a great deal of good under the difficult circumstances. Maybe we take a couple. Well, I suppose I can speak about what I think should be done about all of these matters. I can speak about what I feel should be done about the cities. I can speak about what I think should be done about education. And I should also say that I've been speaking about these matters for several years and talking about what I think needs to be done in this country and the kinds of programs that I think need to be developed, which I think would be effective and would be helpful. And I will continue to speak out on them. And of course, any other candidate is free to express his point of view and his views on what he feels should be done as well. But I speak for myself. I don't speak for anybody else. This gentleman in there. Laws against what? Cannibalism. You mean eating your fellow human being? What? You got me. I don't know. You're right, that's one I haven't got an answer on. Well, I think first, VISTA and the Peace Corps have not only a momentum, but an idealism of the fact that you're going to serve your fellow human being, that you're going to do something for someone else. And I would hate to have injected in that the idea that you were doing it not to serve your fellow human being, but so that you wouldn't have to serve in the armed. And I think that is the danger to it. I think that if you had it in time of peace, if there wasn't any war, I'm in favor of some kind of an effort along those lines. Secondly, I would also be in favor of having a VISTA program established at the state level, of a domestic Peace Corps established at the state level, and I'd bring in college students and I would, as well as older people, and I would also see if we couldn't involve high school students, at least on weekends, who would perform public service.
Keeps pace with America today.
The qu- question was whether I think that the legislative machinery keeps pace with America today. I think we passed a good deal of legislation in 1965, 1966. I think sometimes it's terribly frustrating. But I suppose it also it keeps us from the fact that you have the deliberative body talking about these matters and examining these matters, that it keeps you from making mistakes that we would make otherwise. As Winston Churchill, I think it's part of a democracy. And as Winston Churchill said, democracy is the worst form of government except all others. And I think the legislative machinery is part of that and part of the price that we have to pay. I'll take two more. The lady. Well, I think that the question was basically what we should do about the flow of gold. The basic problem about the flow of gold is the fact that we're spending $30 billion in Vietnam and there's such an outflow of gold with lack of confidence in the United States that they're going to be able to do anything about their economy while that war continues. And I think that the outflow increased over the period of the last few months because they felt there was no chance toward peace, there was no chance in settling the war, and that that outflow would continue to exist and therefore the stability of the dollar would continue to be questioned. I think we have to end that as well as taking some of the other steps that have already been suggested by the... said a few minutes ago, I said that I'd be willing to give my blood to the Viet Cong. Am I willing to make the statement again? I never made that statement in the beginning, so I'm not willing to say it again. I said that what I did say, that if there were people from North Vietnam that the United States had captured or the United States government felt was in its interest to furnish help or assistance, including keeping them alive, that I thought that that was a matter up to the United States government and the Red Cross, and I would support that. I never said that under the present circumstances, with the war going on, that I supported in any way directly or indirectly giving blood to the Viet Cong, nor would I support it at the moment. Thank you very much. Can I just say, can you just give me one more minute, please? This is a difficult primary. This is a difficult primary here in the state of Indiana, but what happens in Indiana is key and essential to what's going on around the rest of the country. I need your help. I think that we can make a major difference here in the United States. Can we just, I think we can make a major difference here in the United States. I think we can develop new programs within our own country. And I think we can make a major difference around the rest of the world. But it can't be just one individual. We can't be one individual. It's gotta be you. And if you would be willing to help in registration, if you'd be willing to go and canvass from house to house, if you'd be willing to address postcards and address letters, if you'd be willing to stamp envelopes, if you'd be willing to do all of the kind of work that makes a campaign successful and effective, that's what's going to make the difference in the state of Indiana. I think that we can do something here in the state of Indiana. I think we can do something here in the United States of America. I think this country can stand for something. I think we can stand for peace. I think we can make much more progress than we have made in the past. But I can only do it with your help and assistance. So I come here to Indiana, and I come here to your university, and I come here to you to ask for your help. Give me your help, and give me your hand over the period of the night.
Best of luck.
The students here at Men's Gymnasium have crowded around the platform where Senator Kennedy has made his speech, and they have temporarily shut off our microphone to Senator Kennedy at the present time. Senator Kennedy ended his speech by asking for the help of the students here at Ball State University and the people of Indiana in his campaign for the presidency of the United States. Senator Kennedy has been here only a little over an hour. He arrived about 10 minutes after 6 o'clock. It's now 13 minutes after 7 p.m. this evening as he is leaving for the Muncie Airport again. There was a motorcade scheduled for the downtown Muncie area. We have learned that this has been totally called off due to the lack of time in the senator's schedule. That motorcade has been called off, and he will go back to the airport, where he will leave for Indianapolis and a rally scheduled tonight at 8 p.m. And that rally will probably be a little bit late since he was rather late in arriving here at Muncie today. He is on his way out of the men's gymnasium now. Still quite a crowd of enthusiastic students around him. He has not made his way out of the men's gym as of yet. Students are on the platform where he spoke. Many rushed up there at the end of his speech, shook his hand, and pledged their support to him. Briefly wrapping up the senator's comments this evening here at Men's Gymnasium, he was first of all introduced by Marshall Hanley, the Democratic chairman here in Muncie in this area. Introduced and recognizes Mrs. Kennedy, was greeted with wild applause from about 8,000 students gathered here in Men's Gymnasium at Ball State University. The senator spoke mainly tonight toward the domestic policy here in the United States. Even as President Johnson is in Honolulu talking peace concerning Vietnam, the senator stayed pretty much away from the Vietnam question, except calling for examination by the people of the United States and stating especially to the college students gathered here that it's going to be very important for them in the future. He said that the younger generation has the least ties to the past and the biggest state in the future, or the biggest stake in the future, excuse me. He also added to this that we should look to the past and benefit from the mistakes that we have made, and we at that time referring to the federal government during his speech. He called for an examination of policies on all aspects of the government and social life here in America. He says we have to know where we are before we know where we can go. He said some act or something for those people less well off than we are. And this, again, seemed to be the main theme of his speech here this evening at Ball State University. Social concern for the fellow man, especially those less fortunate than others. In specific questions today concerning welfare and poverty here in the United States, the senator said he was in favor of jobs instead of welfare here in the United States. And he went on to state that this feeling he had was more.
Transmitting at a frequency of 90.7 megahertz on the FM dial, this is WBST-FM, where you hear the music you want when you want it every evening at 9 o'clock.